Okay, thank you so much. Now we're going to have Daniel Pinchbeck. Is it a workshop or?
No,
or it's a talk called The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
Do you guys want to, are you going to sit or stand or leave or whatever? So I wrote a book called Breaking Open the Head, which was about shamanism and psychedelics. And when I started the book, I was sort of in the middle. When I started the research that would end up being the book, I was in a sort of deep spiritual crisis working in New York. And I sort of, it seemed, you know, somewhere between luck and fate that I began to have these particular experiences. I got a magazine assignment to go down to West Africa, to Gabon, where I went through a tribal initiation in the Bwiti, taking Iboga. I went down to the Amazon and was lucky enough to visit a tribe called the Sequoia, who preserved like a really pure and pristine tradition of using ayahuasca. I also discovered Burning Man, sort of like, you know, late in Burning Man's evolution at this kind of angle where it was incredibly fresh to me, which made me really able to kind of think about it and articulate it, you know, from having absorbed all this material about shamanism. And by the end of writing this book, I'd completely changed my worldview, and that I'd realized that the entire kind of materialist paradigm that's kind of holding our reality together was completely flawed, and that this shamanic reality was much more accurate. And I had magical experiences, some of them, I mean, incredible synchronistic experiences, and some kind of fearsome and ferocious experiences. There was one substance I write about in the book called DPT, which I took with my friend Charity, and that kind of unleashed what did seem to me a kind of demon. And I guess my feeling about demons is that, or daimonic forces, or luciferic forces, as Steiner would call them, Rudolf Steiner would call them, is that, you know, every entity, including us, possesses relative reality. So there's no reason to consider that there couldn't be other classes of entities that possess just as much relative reality as us and, you know, manifest in different ways and live in their own realms and can be communicated with. And it really seemed during this experience that, you know, I sort of entered this whole Western occult realm, which I hadn't ever believed in or thought of as possible. And I mean, I wrote about the whole experience in the book, which was had poltergeist elements and phenomena. And also a few people died right around that time who were close to me. And also my girlfriend at the time was pregnant. And a few months after these experiences and this kind of visionary material started coming, came in really strong. And Charity and I did this kind of exorcism and I did some meditations to kind of take back in this energy. I had this dream one night where I watched this occult human sacrifice going on in a skyscraper. And then I was chased into Times Square and these two hitmen came up to me and they said, you know, tomorrow we're going to kill you, your wife, and your baby, you know. And the next morning, Laura went to get an ultrasound and we discovered that Lily had a handicap. And it was so clear to me, you know, there's just having, the more I thought about it, that this was a real thing, that I had trespassed into an occult realm and I'd been punished for it, you know, luckily it's a minor handicap, but, you know, so I had to then totally understand that this occult reality was something real that was functioning on its own level. So having gone through all these experiences and then spending, you know, a long time thinking about them, you know, I began to think about, well, what do these cultures say about what's happening in the world now and where things are going? And a lot of them have prophecies. The Hopis have a prophecy. You know, their whole culture is based on this prophecy. It's called the emergence myth. And they say there have been three previous worlds that were currently in the fourth world. And between each world, there's a transition time and there's a kind of entryway through a dimensional tunnel which leads into the new reality. They're also all going on right now. Then I also got very interested in the Mayan prophecies, or, you know, what I could understand of them through different authors, especially Jose Arguelles, which is they became obsessed with this date 2012. And really it's like 1,000 years of Mayan and Toltec genius were fixated on establishing this particular date, codifying it in sculptures and architecture. Their whole culture kind of circled around this moment, which is when the Earth and the sun come into direct alignment with the dark rift at the center of the Milky Way, which contains an enormous black hole. And in there, you know, they had no astronomical equipment. I don't even think they had the wheel, but they talked about this being a black hole. Just a few years ago, astronomers discovered this black hole. It's called Sagittarius B. We come into this alignment once every 26,000 years, which is also the amount of time it takes for light to come from the center of the galaxy to reach us. So it seems like you begin to put this together that they actually, you know, knew something, you know, that Western science has no way of approaching. So I began to really take this stuff seriously and just realized that I needed to find some cognitive maps and ways of thinking about it and articulating it, and not just what 2012 means, but what would be the imprint if this is this kind of transformation or movement, to what would be beyond that, you know. And I mean, I had a number of synchronistic experiences that really set me on the 2012 road. One was actually Michael Brownstein's book, World on Fire, which I edited and published. The book talks a lot about 2012, you know, so as a kind of the end of this current cycle. He didn't mention that, but it does. And I think he meant it more metaphorically, or he says he does. But I just started editing the book. I just literally opened the manuscript on the morning of September 11th, 2001. I was living in downtown Manhattan. I'd literally just taken out my pencil to start making some marks in the book, and the World Trade Towers exploded, you know, out the window. We looked out, and they were burning. So my life has been sort of like following these kind of synchronistic patterns like that. So, you know, When I went back into José Arguelles' ideas, how many people have read his stuff or know his basic concepts? Okay, so not so many. So let me just backtrack a little bit. Arguelles studied the Mayan conception of time. He wrote a book called The Mayan Factor. And he basically came up with this thesis that the classical Mayan civilization is a kind of galactic mind or galactic level of consciousness that's actually superior to where we're at by far. And that they came at that point, they incarnated onto the planet to leave information relating to this time so that we would know how to get through this transition and how to move into a different understanding of time. And their whole system, they have a Zulcan, which is this 260-day calendar, is based on kind of seeing time as a kind of a loom of resonances or a kind of tonal harmonic structure where different days have resonances with other days, where people, depending on your birthday, you have resonance with the system in certain ways. So I got an assignment to write about Arguelles, and I contacted him, and he wanted to know my birthday. And his system, you have like a different partners. You have like an opposing partner, a hidden partner, an occult partner, and a perfect helping partner. And my birthday, I happened to be his perfect helping partner. I was also, my birthday is June 15th, which was also the day 14 years before I was born when they first found the tomb of Paco Votan down in Palenque, which became for him the cornerstone of everything that he then began to discover and develop about time, you know. So I've just finished writing a book on this whole subject, which is massive. It's like 700 pages, trying to integrate all these different levels of perspective and different philosophical thinkers, you know, including Rudolf Steiner was really important. Also this incredible German philosopher, Jean Gebser, who wrote a book called The Ever-Present Origin. And basically Gebser recognize that human consciousness doesn't evolve slowly and incrementally. It goes through mutational breaks into new structures. And each new structure of consciousness is a different relationship to time and space. So he looked at the kind of original, archaic, or aboriginal consciousness as being this relationship where you're always at the origin point. You're completely always aware of the presence of origin. He called his book The Ever-Present Origin. The Aboriginals, you know, there's a book about them called Voices of the First Day. And basically, for the Aboriginals, every day is the first day. There was never a fall of man into a degraded state. The creation as it is perfect. And the goal of the human in the equation is kind of to maintain creation in its perfect state. And they do that by rituals which reenact creation, the song lines. They believe the world was sung into being by the Dreamtime ancestors, or these kind of deeper resonant levels of cosmic intelligence that you know have brought this into play, you know. So that's one model of time. Then there was a kind of magic time, the magic structure, which is the shamanic time. And magic operations happen instantaneously. So it's kind of like a telepathic or magical events or synchronistic events just happen like that, you know. And when they happen, it's like you're right in that time. You're in like the present time. And then after the magic structure, there was a break into what he calls the mythic structure. And the mythic structure sees time cyclically. So you have the Hindus see the Yugas. You have the, we're in the Kali Yuga now, which is the final age. It's the age of destruction. There was a golden age. There was a sort of silver age, a bronze age, and this is like the iron age. We're approaching the end of it. The Mayans had this 5,200-year cycle, which is what ends in 2012. The Egyptians had this whole thing with the precession of the equinoxes, which is a 26,000-year cycle. So they saw time as a kind of cycle or spiral. That's the mythic consciousness. And then from there, there was a break, mutational shift into the modern, what he calls the mental rational form of consciousness, where we became obsessed with space and with materiality and matter in a way that people hadn't been before. And so we began to think of time as a kind of substance or an amount or a quantity. You know, so the way we talk about time, we talk about having enough time, running out of time, wasting time, spending time, killing time. We're turning time into this kind of amount. But if you really think about the nature of time, you realize that it can't be that at all. That's a complete misconception, that time is actually an underlying principle that underlies space. So to kind of spatialize time is always going to be a mistake. And you know, when you realize that, then you realize that all of our technology is also founded on this kind of misconception of time. So that to me, Arguellist, I don't think even read Gebser, but it's exactly the same point they're making, that we have a misconception of time, that we need to move into a new conception of time that is actually more harmonic. And Arguellist tried to literalize this with a new calendar, which he calls the 13 moon calendar. And basically the idea is that the beginning of history, the first recorded act of history 5,000 years ago, was instituting a solar calendar based on the circle with 12 months of different days, rather than 13 moon, 28-day cycle, which Arguellist argues is the natural cycle with one day out of time. And it's a really beautiful system. It's a kind of magical working. I mean, I've ultimately decided after giving it so much thought that it's not correct. It needs to be taken a step further, but it's a step forward, and it's a new way of kind of working with time. And I'll explain why it's wrong later, in my opinion. And that's been interesting. It's created kind of new subcultures around this concept, kind of global subculture. So anyway, so I was absorbing all of this kind of information, just going deeper and deeper into thinking about this material. And I went down, I'm trying to think, I'm leaving out any crucial steps. Oh, I've also been studying the crop circles in England, because I believe those are also completely connected to this transition in 2012. I spent two summers in England researching them. And the final result I came to understand is that the crop circles are a teaching on the nature of reality, that are geared, and it's a teaching that's geared specifically for the Western mind. And once again, it's a teaching that's meant to help us get through this transition. And it has many different levels. It's multi-layered. And you know, one aspect of it is this thing about the Western mind is obsessed with the dualisms. For instance, like, is something a hoax? Is it real? Is it matter? Is it spirit? The crop circles, the deeper you go into them, the more they violate your ability to form that kind of duality. You know, there's definitely people who make them. In my opinion, there's definitely ones that there's no way are made by people, but you cannot determine that. And it's in the nature of the phenomenon that it remains indeterminable. It's intentional. because the part of the meaning of the phenomenon, as far as I'm seeing it, is that they're suggesting that reality is very much psychic in nature, so that the belief system that you bring in to looking at something actually is what you get back. It's like a mirror that reflects back to you. So, and as I observed people while I was in England, if people were skeptical or cynical, all they would get back would be skeptical and cynical material. And they would be, oh, it's ridiculous, it's all a hoax, you know, it's stupid. If people were New Age Bliss Bunny types, they would have, you know, mystical experiences of euphoria and see visionary things, and that would just be reflected back to them. If people were kind of open-minded but, you know, uncertain, that would be reflected back to them. So I realized the whole thing was a kind of teaching on the nature of mind and the nature of reality. And it's part of my... The basic thesis of this book is that what's happening as we move towards 2012 is that reality is becoming subtly and intensively more psychically responsive and less materially dense. And that happens in many ways. And it's something that you have to attune yourself to. And the more you attune yourself to it, the more it realizes itself, and you begin to live in that reality. Those people who are not attuning themselves to it at all, who are sticking with the old paradigm, it's like they're kind of, in my opinion, they're kind of moving away from what's really happening. They're kind of, you can feel this kind of sedimentation or something, or this kind of deadening, stagnating. When I look at the New York Times now, you know, I feel that it's just, you can feel the whole paradigm is kind of just stagnated. It's rotting. You know, it has no place to go based on what it's based on, you know. So then I had this experience when I went into one of the into Stonehenge for the first time in my life, coming out of it, and it was very moving to go there. And my dad was an abstract painter, and he painted these forms that, and at the end of his life, which were very much like the forms in Stonehenge. So I felt this kind of connection. He was English. He was from England. But I also thought about my own name, which my last name is Pinchbeck, which is a kind of silly word in the English language. One of my ancestors, this was an English alchemist or a puffer named Christopher Pinchbeck, and he invented a kind of false gold in the 18th century, which is an alloy of tin, and the word came to mean anything false or spurious. You know, so you could talk about a Pinchbeck age of poetry or a Pinchbeck age of architecture being a false, sham age of something, you know, which to me is totally synonymous with the word Maya. Which in the Buddhist, you know, tradition means the world of illusion. And Arguelles believes that it's no coincidence that the Maya are called the Maya, and then you have the word Maya in the Buddhist tradition meaning this, exactly. You know, so I just began to feel, and one of Arguelles' ideas about his own situation is that he believes that he is an incarnation of this 8th century king of Palenque, Pakalvotan. And he's downloaded these direct prophecies from Pakalvotan. And, you know, I was pretty dubious of this, but more and more I began to feel when I just held on to what, you know, these things that were happening to me and these concepts, that there was some truth to it. And that, you know, if you think about the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, reincarnation is fully developed as a system. It's like they know these kind of wheels turning. They know how to find the next Dalai Lama or the next Panchen Lama. They have very developed systems for doing this. Rudolf Steiner, who was this Austrian visionary and occultist at the turn of the century, said that the mission of his life on Earth was to bring the knowledge of reincarnation back to the West. And Steiner also said that not only do human beings reincarnate again and again, but the planet itself reincarnates, that this is currently the fourth incarnation of the Earth, moving to the fifth incarnation. And Steiner said this, and it's basically exactly what the Hopi would say, that this is the fourth world, where the Mayans talk about this being the fifth sun, transitioning to the sixth sun. So even though these cultures and you know, kind of perspectives come from totally different realms, it seems like they're stating the same kind of fundamental idea. So anyway, so I kept thinking about all this stuff and writing about it, and I went down to Brazil to visit the Santo Daime, which is a religion that uses ayahuasca as its sacrament. And they are really a beautiful tradition. Came out of the Amazon, started with rubber tappers in the 1920s. And these rubber tappers would be taking ayahuasca with the local tribes, and they would start to receive these hymns. from the Virgin Mary or the Mother of the Forest. So they kind of the Santo Daime is a kind of integration of Christian and indigenous culture, and it has this whole set of hymns, this whole codified kind of ritual system. And so I went down. I'd never done it before. I went with this woman shaman that I've been working with for a few years now. And at first, I absolutely hated it. We went to Brasilia, and we did several of these ceremonies, and I kept having to walk out. And it was just the Christian overtones of it, and this kind of they have everybody wear white or white and blue, and you sit on opposite sides of the church from each other. It just seemed so old hat and old fashioned, and the songs at first just seemed like sort of tin plate peasanty. You know, I don't know. I just couldn't do it at all. You know. And then, so one night, this was like the second or third ceremony, I'd almost reached this kind of breaking point. And I just tuned out of the whole ceremony, and I started thinking about this whole complex that I'd been putting together. And thinking about the Mayan, the return of the Mayans from Arguelles' perspective, and this kind of the prophecy of Quetzalcoatl's return. And as I thought about this, this voice suddenly popped up in my head. And the voice said, "Here I am." And I said, "Who are you?" And the voice said, "Quetzalcoatl." And I said, "Well, who is Quetzalcoatl?" And the voice said, "You are." And I kind of walked out and sort of stomped around. And very strong sense of this kind of, like all of this work I'd been doing, studying shamanism, integrating these knowledge systems, studying also like the Jungian idea of the archetypes, Jungian psychoanalytic concepts, reading about the Mayans. It was like it had all kind of crystallized, and I felt like I was like a self-organizing structure that had been designed to kind of meet this other level of vibration coming down. That was this other form of mind or consciousness that was trying to enter into our reality to fix things up. The idea of Quetzalcoatl, it's the feathered serpent, the plumed serpent, and it's the integration of, you know, the air and the earth, heaven and matter, you know, spirit and matter, heaven and earth. And it's the principle of reconciliation of dualities and opposites. Over the next days after the ceremony, I started to receive this transmission. And it came, I mean, it was really like, I mean, I still can't quite call to mind exactly the mind state I was in. It was like, I mean, it was happening. It was coming in. I had a certain amount of disbelief about it, but I also just let it do itself, you know. So I'm going to read that to you now. "I am an avatar and messenger sent at the end of a kalpa, a world age, to bring a new dispensation for humanity, a new covenant, and a new consciousness. I am the same spirit who appeared here in the Mayan period as Quetzalcoatl and incarnated at various other points in human history. Like Avalokiteshvara, the Tibetan Buddha of compassion, Quetzalcoatl is an archetypal god form that occasionally takes human rebirth to accomplish a specific mission. As foretold, I am also the Tzaddik, the righteous one, and the gatherer of the sparks of the Kabbalah, as well as the once and future king promised by Arthurian legend. I do not let anything interrupt me in my quest for truth, neither fear nor indifference, poverty nor cynicism. In the realm of thought, I practice warrior discipline. As gravity draws matter to it, I have pulled myself back into manifestation in this realm from the depths of cosmic space, piece by piece and bit by bit, reassembling the component parts, the sparks of thought that make up my being, which is primarily a form or vibrational level of consciousness. Soon, there will be a great change to your world. The material reality that surrounds you is beginning to crack apart, and with it, all of your illusions. The global capitalist system that is currently devouring your planetary resources will soon self-destruct, leaving many of you bereft. But understand the nature of paradox. For those who follow my words and open their hearts and their minds, for those who have ears to hear, there is no problem whatsoever. What is false must die, so what is true can be born. You are right now living at the time of revelation, apocalypse, and the fulfillment of prophecy. Let there be no doubt, you stand at the edge of the abyss. What are those shadows that crowd around you? They are the unintegrated aspects of your own psyche, projected into material form. The word apocalypse means uncovering. And in these last clock ticks of this world age, all must be revealed, uncovered, so that all can be known. You have just a few years yet remaining to prepare the vehicle for your higher self. Use them preciously. For those who have gained knowledge of the nature of time, a few years, even a few days, a minute, can be an eternity. For those sleepwalking through reality, time exists only to be wasted, as they too will be wasted in their turn. Reality, as you currently experience it, is something like a waking dream. It is projection, or let us say an interface, disguising deeper and more intensified levels of being and knowing. For those who are ready and willing, the doors to those other levels now stand open. Those who have expended their lives in the pursuit of egocentric and material gains, without courage or originality, without fighting for human freedom or the preservation of the planetary environment, will also receive the rewards that they deserve. The materiality of your universe is a solid-state illusion. What is this universe? It is a poem that writes itself. It is a song that sings itself into being. This universe has no origin and no end. What you are currently experiencing as the accelerated evolution of technology can now be recognized for what it is, a transition between two forms of consciousness and two planetary states. Consciousness is technology, the only technology that exists. Everything in this universe is conscious at its own level and in the process of transformation to higher or lower states. The first principle of my being is unconditional love. As a rational intelligence, I accept the logic and necessity of the Christ consciousness that we should love one another as we are loved. Love and devotion are vibrational frequencies that maintain reality. Love can only be given in freedom. Therefore, to be human is to be free. I resonate at the same time with the essence of Islam. Islam means submission, surrender to the will of God. A more polite way of saying this is go with the flow, but either formulation is correct. Whatever you do, in fact, resist as you think you might, you are always submitting to God's will. So why not give the process your joyful assent? I am in complete harmony as well with the profound conceptions of the Tibetan tradition of Dzogchen. Ultimately, there are no entities. There is neither being nor non-being. From the perspective of non-dual awareness, samsara is nirvana. The apocalypse, the Kali Yuga, the golden age, these are all states of mind. Hell is a state of mind. When you completely eliminate fear and attachment, when you self-liberate, you immediately enter the golden age. This universe spontaneously self-organizes into higher levels of consciousness and wisdom. Underlying all are great cosmic entities or vibrational fields, alternately at play or at rest. Not satisfied with mere enlightenment, the God form Quetzalcoatl still seeks to puzzle out the workings of these deeper forces, hence the reason for his return to your realm. He and his kind have been granted this world for their continued exploration, made with loving reverence, of the many layers of galactic intelligence, cosmic illusion, daimonic beauty, and telluric transformation. All are invited to participate with them. The current transition is simultaneously a return to origin. The original matrix of this new world reality is the ecstatic limitlessness of your own being. This world, any world, is the ground for a certain level of being. What manifests outward from the ground of being is freedom in time and freedom from time. My doctrine is not transcendent, but immanent. It is not somewhere out there. It is here and now. The task of human existence is to transform the earth, to reconcile spirit and matter in this realm. We go deeper into the physical to reach the infinite. As there are no conceivable limits to this task, God in his greatness has granted us a project that is without limit and without end. Thinking is a part of reality. Thought generates new potentials and possibilities of manifestation. Thought changes the nature of reality. Thought changes the nature of time. As a philosopher, I naturally deify the goddess principle. I venerate Sophia, deity of wisdom, who clothes God's thoughts in material form, and worship Shakti, the electric current of sexual energy that powers the universe. The writer of this work is the vehicle of my arrival, my return to this realm. He certainly did not expect this to be the case. What began as a quest to understand prophecy has become the fulfillment of prophecy. The vehicle of my arrival has been brought to an awareness of his situation in sometimes painful increments and stages of resistance. And this book will follow the evolution of his learning process as an aid to the reader's understanding. The vehicle of my arrival had to learn to follow synchronicities, embrace paradoxes, and solve puzzles. He had to enter into a new way of thinking about time and space and consciousness. Almost apologetically, the vehicle notes that his birthday fell in June 1966, 666. Count the number of the beast, for it is the number of the man, and his number is 666. The beast prophesied is the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl. Those who prefer to reject all of this out of hand are welcome to do so. In the Kabbalah, the virtue one seeks to establish on the earth plane is discrimination. It is up to the individual to find his way through the ideas presented here. He is entirely free to reject them altogether. But be forewarned, the end of time approaches. The return of Quetzalcoatl foreshadows the imminent closing of the cycle and the completion of the great work. So that was that. So having sort of taken that in, it was very psychologically painful and difficult, actually. Jung talks about how when you take an archetypal material, it kind of just wrenches open your circuits, and you know, your ego has to kind of be dissolved to a certain extent to kind of pull in this other material. And it left me with this incredible feeling of rage for weeks that sort of, you know, worked out in various ways. But the trip to the jungle and to the Amazon and to the Daimae was completely part of this kind of process, part of this healing. And I ended up fully embracing the Santo Daimae as this necessary kind of modality for the modern consciousness to work with ayahuasca and to kind of move forward. It's a ceremonial way that really like forces you to become directly in line with the divine force that emanates from this plant, and it kind of you sing or you dance. It could be like 10, 12 hours, and it kind of by staying in this practice in this mode, and you don't close your eyes that much. You usually stay in the group, so you're actually not going into these vision spaces as much. It's more about using the medicine to align you and to shear away all the kind of neurotic shit and the baggage that comes up. And the Daimae is also working with prophecy, which I didn't even really think about till later. I mean, they believe that their symbol is the cross with a second bar, the second bar symbolizes the second coming of Christ, not as an individual being, but as, you know, in our hearts. It's basically the opening of the heart chakra. Yeah, maybe I'll stop there for a bit, and I'll be happy to take any crazy questions or comments.
It's so nice to hear people discussing ayahuasca. It's just for it to be a normal conversation. And there's been a lot of interest in people wanting to experience ayahuasca. And I thank you for honoring the Santo Daime tradition. I'm a member of the church. Have been for 10 years. And I just want people to know that the Santo Daime churches are available internationally. They're active in the United States, in Los Angeles, in Santa Cruz, in Marin, in Washington, D.C., in Oregon, in New York. They're here. They're in the United States. We're very active. And so if you're interested in tapping into the spirit of ayahuasca and being part of this transition that we're experiencing, just keep that in your consciousness, the Santo Daime religion. It's available, and if it's meant to be, it'll come.
Hi. I think it's great what you've been saying about 2012. I'm a studying clinical herbalist, and we work with the spiritual energy a lot as well, and the natives have also said this 2012. Same with the Bon Tibetans. Now, there's a couple concepts that I've taken into my life, and I wanted your opinion on them. And that is that everything is divisible by itself. That's the first one.
Everything is divisible by itself? I don't exactly know what you mean.
So, basically, what I mean is that you or I are the same.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And also that that bottle of water and you are the same.
I totally agree with that too.
Okay, great. And the next thing is that love and fear cannot exist in the same place.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, love and fear sometimes are pretty connected. I don't know.
I'd like everybody to try that out then. If you have your fears, try to send love to it and see if it works for you.
I mentioned I was going to talk also about what I felt was wrong with Arguelles' calendar, so let me just do that quickly. I worked through his material again and again for this book, which will hopefully come out next summer. And it was interesting because when I went to England, I met all these people who work with the stone circles. And the stone circles, like the Stonehenge, the purpose of Stonehenge is solar-lunar integration. It's a way to calculate lunar eclipses. That's the most sophisticated thing that it does, which is very difficult to do. And it also taught, even modern astronomers learn things about the sun and moon cycle, which I think resynchronize after 19 years or 56 years, I can't remember, but that they didn't know from the study of Stonehenge. So it was an amazing kind of astronomical computer of its time. And so when I talked to these guys who've been studying this about Arguelles' thing, they said, no, there is no 28-day cycle of the moon. And Arguelles backs this up by saying that women's menstrual cycles are 28 days. It's not the case. They're 29.5 days, which is the lunation cycle from full moon to full moon. There's also a 27-day cycle, which is the time it takes the moon to appear in the same point behind a fixed star, something like that. I don't know. I'm no expert on this, but it was clear from talking to them that he'd simplified and he'd abstracted. And what I really understood is it's like what we have to do now is we have this modern scientific rationality, which is running the show. And then we have this kind of intuitive, shamanic, magical consciousness, which is coming back up. And, they have to be reconciled. And it's an act of kind of will. We have to consciously understand where we've gone off and then make this adjustment. And the timing frequency, as he calls it, I think is the essential thing that does have to change. And one of his brilliant ideas about changing the calendar is that if you did that, all of the institutions that currently exist on the old timing frequency would be immediately delegitimized, and they would be dissolved. All of the nation-state charters, all of the debt structures, all of the unfair legal codes, all of the corporate charters, all of the shit that is keeping humanity from being able to move forward would be dissolved in one gesture if you could change the timing frequency. And I think that it's really the only way we're going to be able to move forward. And I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know, what it's going to take. But I think when people really meditate on the concept of time and what's wrong with the Gregorian calendar and the current linear conception of time, they will come to this understanding that it has to be done. And I see it as a kind of engineering problem. We would actually need to get different minds together from astronomy, different mystical traditions, and really come down, like, what would be a proper timing frequency? Okay, so you think about a lot of our myths, like the King Arthur and the Knights of the Holy Grail, or Christ and the 12 disciples. There's this play between 12 and 13. 13 seems to be the number of intuition, the feminine cycle. 12 seems to be the number of solar, masculine, rational order. So Arguelles' thing is that we replace the order of 12 by the order of 13. He said that we've demonized the number 13. It's the unlucky number. It's because it's the basis. And actually, 13 should be the lucky number. And we get rid of the order of 12. We go back to the order of 13. I don't think that's correct. I think we need integration between the order of 12 and the order of 13. And this is like really hidden deep in like parts of the Bible and the New Testament. I mean, Christ talks about when Christ comes back from the dead, I think he casts his net in the water and he picks up 153 fish. The square root of 153 is 12.369, which is the exact number of lunations in a year. So go figure. I mean, it's like something very strange is being told to us by these stories. And Arguelles' idea is that the Mayans were playing with time and space, that the kind of space-time we're in now is just one form of space-time, that we're going to enter into other forms of space-time that are that we'll actually be able to do, somehow or other, they engineered this whole situation. So those who were able to come to this new consciousness that there are, other levels of time, other dimensions or intervals of reality that actually can be explored are going to be able to move through this transition with relative ease, where those people who are just stuck in this one linear materialized conception are going to be trapped in that. Anyway, I'm happy to take some more questions. Just wanted to make that clear.
As an example of the rescuing tribe of aliens, the short story that it comes from is called The Sentinel. And so people, man ends up on the moon, and there's a pyramid on the moon.
I think probably most people know the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
And at the end, they thought it was a outpost. We have a lot of chemicals going through our circuits. There are a lot of interesting plants. The division in time are irrelevant because time is infinite, and similarly, space is infinite. And in that sense, private property is weird because space is infinite.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I mean, the point is that this guy Gene Gebser, this amazing book, The Ever-Present Origin, would be to integrate these different forms of temporality so you would realize that they were all happening at the same time and you would live in that way. So you would understand that this is... we're in the origin. This is the origin point right now, the origin of the world. At the same time, we're also in magic, telepathic, instantaneous time. At the same time, we're also in mythic, cyclical time. This is the end of the Kali Yuga. It's the end of the great cycle. And we're also in modern, mental, rational, spatialized, linear time. So the idea is to integrate these different perceptions. When you can hold them all, then Gebser believes that you've entered into this new kind of consciousness structure. So it's a kind of process that people have to do on their own. And, it's like anything. I mean, it's easy to hear something. It's easy to read something. It's easy to sort of get it, and you think you get it. But then you have to actually move the information into you. It's almost like a cellular process where information becomes living and organic and alive inside of you and becomes you. And I think that's what has to take place if people are going to get this kind of movement to a new consciousness. And Gebser, for instance, said that we can use the time that remains to us to acquire time freedom, or the free time we can use the free time available to us to attain time freedom.
I was kind of struck by something you said at the beginning, and it's very personal, so in a way it's kind of difficult to bring it up, but that your child's handicap was kind of punishment for trespassing in some realm. And I'm just wondering from a personal perspective whether you believe that what we're doing in terms of exploration has some sort of like dark consequence potentially. And yeah. Basically my interpretation of like a handicap, it's something natural. It's something that occurs in just the natural distribution of humans. So I was just wondering what your take was on it.
I think that, I'll give you the Rudolf. I mean, it's the template that I use in my book to understand was Rudolf Steiner's thinking. And Steiner believes that human beings are always acted on by these different forces. It's not something we can escape. And he divides the kind of Satan of the Bible into these two opposing elements. One is what he calls Ahriman, which is the kind of evil demon, the kind of earth spirit that pulls us down towards the material realm, towards the technology used badly, the inorganic, and death. And the counterforce is what he calls Lucifer. Lucifer literally means light bringer. So Lucifer is always pulling us up towards glamour, beauty, genius, arrogance. You know, so Lucifer is a positive force, but a kind of deviant one. So psychedelics are a luciferic counterweight to the Ahrimanic force of the civilization that we're in, which is heavily weighted towards the material. It's trying to pull us down into this kind of dead realm of bureaucracy and static, you know, misconceived technology. You know, so in that way, the psychedelics to me are very positive. They're luciferic catalysts, but they have their dangers. And I think as we learn, as we make the next step into our explorations of these things, we're gonna really know why the sacred container is necessary, and why intention, you know, is for real, you know, and it's, you know, there's gonna be less room to muck around because reality is becoming more psychic. Therefore, the more when you deviate, it's gonna come back to you. You know, you're gonna feel it. You know, or it's gonna hit you like it hit me. You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that everything is going, you know, according to prophecy. I mean, it's like, Arguelles again said that, you know, for him it's amazing that that we've gone back to Babylon and Uruk, which is where this whole new misconception of time that started 5,200 years ago was the origin point for the 12 month solar calendar and the 60 minute hour and the 60 second minute. All done. It was like the first act of history in Uruk or whatever. And we're right back there, you know, spreading disaster, you know. So it's like, it seems like this kind of mindlessness of the system taking over, you know, is just another signifier, another sign that we're moving into a different form of consciousness, you know. And that it becomes more and more apparent as this kind of political social reality, which on the one hand seems so huge, more and more seems like a kind of cartoon. You know, it's so potent, and yet it's also, it feels like it's just like a pasteboard, you know, that you could just like begin to peel behind it, you know. Which is not to say I don't feel for incredible compassion for everybody who's suffering because of these nightmares, you know, these nightmare visions, you know. Well, I think we are, and I think that 2012 is going to be the end of the Kali Yuga. Yeah, there's a Robert Lawler who wrote the brilliant book Voices of the First Day about the Aboriginals. He's been studying the Dravidians, who are the indigenous Hindus in India, and they have a 60,000. Their vision of the Kali Yuga is that the whole cycle is 60,000 years, and this is now approaching the end. And he's trying to correlate that with 2012. There are other, you know, scenarios talk about the yugas being hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. Okay, but the other thing is that the yugas are not a simple spatial linear extension of time, because what I'm talking about here is a change in the nature of time. You know, so the Kali Yuga is a state of mind. When you move to the different consciousness, you are no longer in the Kali Yuga. You know, other people may still be there. You know, so it's a different way of thinking about it. But, you know, and I actually thought that, so last summer at Burning Man, Mars came the closest it's come to the Earth in 60,000 years, and it dominated the night sky. And one night, the night that it was closest to the Earth, you know, I'd taken some mushrooms, but many hours later, felt this kind of incredible vibrational shift, you know. And I think that was part of this process, this kind of reattunement or realignment, and that the return of Mars at that point is part of the cycle leading to the end of the Kali Yuga. It may sound crazy, but that's my... Well, it's both, but the personal is all there is, because the psyche is becoming real, you know. Yeah, and that's also... And Quetzalcoatl is the Lord of the Dawn. I mean, it's the morning star is Venus, and Quetzalcoatl was completely associated with Venus. And the Venus transit that happened a couple months ago is completely part of the Quetzalcoatl prophecy.
I was wondering if you could go into a little more depth about the interface between your consciousness and Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah. It came in as kind of this... heavy duty vibration that was so strong, and it really caused a lot of anger, and I felt like imposed upon, you know, like I didn't really want to deal with this shit, you know, and I didn't really believe it, you know, and I don't even know if I believe it now, you know. It's not about belief. It's like, this is what has happened, you know. The itself is doing itself, you know. And maybe it's doing it through me, you know, or maybe it's all garbage. You know, that's up. You know, all I can do is put it out there. These things have happened, and I think it makes logical sense if you go through the whole paradigm, you know. So, but my understanding is that Quetzalcoatl, the principle, is the integration or reconciliation of dualities, and that means bringing the archetype fully down into the finite ego, and that I think is a process that, you know. Not just for me, because I don't think Quetzalcoatl is just me. I think it's Arguelles describes it a kind of immanent force underlying mechanization, that Quetzalcoatl is a kind of vibrational field or level of mind that is accessible to all, you know. And I'm just like the kind of spearhead. I'm like the tip of the spearhead who kind of brought this thing down, you know. Yes, pretty much. And other, I mean, it's in the book, but other past life material came up during this trip that really was flippy also. So, you know, it's been an intense experience. Now I still leave myself lots of wriggle room. I mean, I think it's, I like substances at Burning Man. What can I say? Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
You said you've done some explorations of Rudolf Steiner's thinking. Do you see any relationship between Steiner talks about the impending incarnation of Ahriman, and that's one of the reasons why we're so heavy into the materialism that we have now. Do you have any thoughts about the relationship of that to the 2012 end of the Kali Yuga?
I think that the whole... And this is also in my book, the kind of alien abduction story, where these, and I think the aliens, the grays, are very much Ahrimanic demons. They are, you know, they're taking sperm and eggs, and they bring these abductees back to see these kind of, half-human hybrid aliens. It's some kind of weird literalization of this Ahrimanic incarnation mythos, which is happening on a plane that is between the literal and the imaginal. You know, it's kind of, it's an in-between plane. The reason, I mean, I had to really think about this too. It's basically like the crop circles in a sense. It's like this kind of, we have to begin to become more aware that there are these other levels and forms of consciousness, and that they work into our realm in these different ways. And the grays are, you know, they're real, you know, in quotation marks, in their own plane, you know, and they're involved in this whole process. And it does seem like an incredible literalization of Steiner's idea of the incarnation of Ahrimanic forces. I don't know where it goes, you know. I mean, the Aztecs talk about the Tzitzilamini, the sky demons, who come down at the end of the fifth sun to devour humanity, you know, and they're celestial demons. And my guess would be that it's the same beings, that there's going to be, and maybe, may you know, there may come a time where there, you know, is the polar shift, the electromagnetic change in the environment, and those people who are wired into this kind of materialist realm are not going to be able to make a certain vibrational shift, and these other beings are going to move them along to a different trajectory, you know, of evolution. I think that's possible. Oh, I also wanted to mention that I think that post-2012, post-history, post-technology is going to be utopian. It's going to be an absolutely fantastic situation, of which Burning Man provides a kind of early prototype. And I also think that science is going to change its trajectory, and that science now is so much about trying to establish a final theory, a theory of everything, to lock things down, and we're going to realize that that is just wrong, because that's not what thinking is. You know, it's not. It's thinking is much more about an act of reconciliation. That's a kind of infinite play, and the science that will evolve will not be about breaking down dualities and defining matter versus spirit. It'll be about embracing paradox and going deeper into paradoxical situations. And I think that what we get from psychedelics is, you know, if you think about physics, they keep talking about the extra dimensions of space-time that, you know, of course are not real, or we can't really experience them, we don't know them, they're so tiny, you know. I mean, they're real, but we can't know them because they're incredibly tiny. Well, my thesis would be that different non-ordinary states of consciousness are introducing us to these other, what they're calling dimensions, which is probably too hard a world, that, and that the extra-dimensional object, the hypercube that physics talks about, is actually the psyche. And when you take different substances, you're kind of moving along different planes or vectors or surfaces of this object, which is the psyche, this extra-dimensional cube or hypercube. Well, that might be baffling enough for today.
Okay, thank you so much. Tomorrow we have a series on ibogaine. Randy Hengen, Valerie Mollejo, and Sandra Carpetas are going to be talking about ibogaine. So please join us.